Everyone, it's the takeaway for June 11th. 4 million people have fled Venezuela, and most of them have gone to Colombia.
It's just a steady trickle of people that are leaving through any border that they can find, and it's not something that we have any reason to think will slow down.
How Colombia is handling the influx as they deal with their own increasing political instability. Also on the show, we bring you some of the takeaways panel discussion in Salt Lake City on the crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women and girls.
She just disappeared one day, and they don't know what's happened to her. And that happens every day. This is normal for us.
And what the auto industry fears if the Trump administration rolls back Obama-era emission standards.
Lawsuits and litigation going on for years and years, total market uncertainty, a mix of states that have one standard and a mix of states that have other standards, total nightmare scenario.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Don't worry, folks, we'll hold your hand through all of it. Let's start this up. After a four-month closure, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro reopened the country's border with Colombia this weekend. Thousands of Venezuelans crossed into Colombia, most just for the day, seeking food and medical assistance. As the country's humanitarian and political crisis continues to unfold, life has become even more difficult for many Venezuelans. So far, 4 million Venezuelans have fled the country, and Colombia has taken the bulk of their neighbors' refugees. The United Nations estimates that 1.3 million Venezuelan refugees are currently living in Colombia. Some have received residence permits, but many are living in refugee camps or on the streets. It's a challenging migrant crisis for a country that's dealing with its own issues, including a regrouping of the militant dissident group, the FARC. I have two guests with me now who've been covering the impact of Venezuela's instability on the region. Brian Ellsworth is Venezuela Bureau Chief for Reuters, and he's in Caracas, Venezuela. And Tamara Tarasuk-Broner joins us from Buenos Aires, Argentina. She's a senior researcher covering the Americas for Human Rights Watch. Brian, let's start with you. Can you describe what happened when the section of the border was open between Colombia and Venezuela?
Well, the border has been closed since February 23rd as a result of the opposition's effort to bring aid into the country, which the government did not want. The opening of the border basically legalized what was a lot of traffic that was happening anyway. So people had for months been using back roads to move back and forth between the two countries. A lot of people who live near the border have to go across the border to buy basic things like groceries, or there are a lot of people who work on one side and live on the other, or more extreme cases of people will need things like dialysis treatment. So they will have to go across the border. And they were having to do this through illegal channels that were controlled basically by criminal networks that were charging them tolls. So now that the borders are open, people can go across the bridge, which there still isn't vehicle traffic, but it means that at least there is a legal avenue for people to go back and forth.
And Tamara, the border opening was just the latest development in the ongoing crisis in Venezuela. What's the scale of the exodus from Venezuela at this point?
The latest available statistics from the United Nations say that more than 4 million Venezuelans have fled the country in recent years. That is over 10% of the population. And one important point is that this is the number that has been recorded by the United Nations. As Brian was saying, you know, there has been a lot of back and forth through the checkpoints that are not the bridge and are not the legal checkpoints. And just to give you a sense, in the Venezuela-Colombia border, you have 7 official checkpoints and over 270 unofficial crossings. So it's very, very difficult to know the real extent of the exodus.
And can you tell us a little bit, Tamara, what the conditions are that people in Colombia are living in?
Venezuelans crossing the border, when you go to the border, what you see is more and more people that are fleeing the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. So people cross the border, as Brian was saying, to buy groceries and go back, but you see a lot of people who are crossing the border to get medical care. And you have a total problem in hospitals in Colombia that are having a very hard time providing health care both to the Colombian population and the Venezuelan population arriving. And you also have a situation at the border and in other parts of Colombia and Latin America, I would say, in which countries are struggling to receive immigrants in economies that are not prepared for that.
Brian, with the political crisis in Venezuela, has there been a rise in the number of people attempting to leave the country?
Well, it's very hard to know, as Tamara says. It's not something that is particularly closely recorded. It's something we definitely hear a lot more about. So the Colombian border is sort of the logical place to go because that's where the roads take people. Some have also been leaving through Brazil. We also have had some recent tragedies, including the sinking of a passenger launch on the way to Trinidad that was also carrying migrants. We've had two such situations. So we definitely hear of more of these kinds of things going on, but the overall big picture of it is it's just a steady trickle of people that are leaving through any border that they can find or whatever the most logical choice for them is. And it's not something that we have any reason to think will slow down.
Tamara, we've reported a lot about the sort of lack of humanity almost that comes across in handling the crisis here at the U.S. southern border when it comes to migrants. The United States is obviously dealing with this. Europe is dealing with this. How do those compare to the treatment of migrants by Colombian and other South American officials?
It's actually very interesting because Venezuela is a country that used to welcome immigrants from other parts of the region in the 70s and 80s, people fleeing dictatorships in South America, people fleeing Colombia's armed conflict, and in a way that has set the stage for a more welcoming Latin America society to Venezuelan immigrants. However, it's a very big risk because as the numbers increase, the immigration of Venezuelans is generating tensions, and there have been some incidents of xenophobia that are not widespread at the moment, but that is clearly a risk that we need to watch out for.
Brian, we know that Colombian President Iván Duque has been urged to extend Colombian citizenship to babies born there to Venezuelan parents. We know that that's a big issue here in the United States. We discussed this. How likely is it that that would happen?
I don't see that being particularly likely. The Venezuelan population in Colombia is above a million, as we understand it right now, and is likely to grow. Colombian social service agencies just don't know what to do with the influx of refugees. There's an undercurrent of xenophobia that, if the situation is not controlled, could start to rise and cause unpleasant situations. There's a lot of pressure, I think, on Colombia. Obviously, what they want is a change of government in Venezuela, which would allow at least some of these people to return. I can't see at the moment right now the Colombian authorities approving that. I'm just not sure that the political environment would be conducive to it, even though there are a lot of people who would be in favor of that.
And Brian, are migrants traveling to other South American countries, like Brazil or Peru, perhaps?
Absolutely. The folks who leave through the Brazilian border, as I understand it, tend to stay in the north of Brazil. That's where they end up being concentrated. The migrants who leave through Colombia, which is where sort of the road system goes through, a lot of them, obviously they'll start in Colombia, but a lot of them quickly realize that Colombia has a lot of Venezuelan migrants already. So many of them for a couple of years now will continue on. So some get as far south as Chile, but there are now significant populations in Ecuador and Peru as well.
Tamara, as you mentioned earlier, Venezuela has a history of accepting immigrants and migrants. People from in the region from countries like Colombia and Argentina did seek refuge in Venezuela not too long ago. Your family was a part of that. Has Venezuela changed in that regard?
Yeah, my parents are Argentine and they fled Argentina's military dictatorship in the late 1970s. That's why I was born in Venezuela. And it's a country that now is expelling its people. It's actually the Venezuelan authorities who are, you know, cracking down on dissent, have not adopted measures to address the humanitarian emergency that Venezuelans in the country are facing. The economic situation is very, very complicated. And this is what is causing people to flee. And I would say, as Brian was saying earlier, not only is there no reason to think that this will change, if there is no real change in Venezuela, I would confidently predict that the number of Venezuelans fleeing the country will continue to grow. And that is an irony, because as you were saying, this is a country that used to welcome people.
And also, Colombia itself is dealing with its own issues, Tamara. In 2016, Colombia signed a peace deal with FARC, which mandated that they lay down their arms, but FARC militants are not going away so quickly. Is this impacting refugees or how the Colombian government is responding to them?
There's clearly a link there. We've done research in areas, in border areas controlled by armed groups in Colombia. And what you see is that there are not only Colombian civilians who are victims of the armed group's abuses, but you also see Venezuelans who crossed the border fleeing Venezuelan's crisis and now are in the middle of Colombia's armed conflict, suffering the same abuses that Colombian civilians suffer, but in a much more precarious situation because these Venezuelans in these areas have no access to a legal state in Colombia. And that makes them much more vulnerable to abuse and to become part of illicit activities.
Brian, just want to wrap up with you. I mean, what do you see as the long-term impact here on the region of this mass exodus of Venezuelans?
The region has never seen a displacement of people like this one. Perhaps Colombia during the Civil War era would be the most comparable, and it was nowhere on this scale. I think the impact is we're looking at a growing strain on social services. We're looking at the potential isolation of Venezuelans into communities that do not have access to basic things, starting with citizenship, as you noted earlier, as well as the possibility of becoming integrated into these societies. This is something that countries, Latin American countries, are just not prepared for, as they do not have economies that can absorb this level of migration of people who are, in effect, been made destitute by their own country's circumstances. I would think that the long-term concerns without these issues being addressed are problems of xenophobia, isolation, and overall just growth of problems, sort of social problems that are endemic to any refugee situation. So there are a lot of multilateral organizations trying to address the issues, but the problem, as it continues to grow, will require a greater level of resources, and it's not evident how much will be available to address it.
And Brian, do we know the United States' position on this? And the Trump administration specifically has supported the insurgent Juan Guaido, who appears to have lost whatever edge he had so far. And at the same time, the United States has made it very clear that they are not interested in taking in migrants, particularly from Central and South America. What is our position in all this?
The migration from Venezuela is not, I mean, in, you know, 5-10 years ago, there were much smaller numbers who people were migrating for slightly different reasons. The current refugee exodus is not, I would say, going to directly affect immigration flows to the United States. The United States has made clear that it wants Maduro gone, but it has not, along with the opposition, they've not yet been able to actually make that happen. I think part of what's going on is the United States is trying to pressure for a quick solution for political reasons, but I also think the region really desperately needs it.
Brian Ellsworth is the Reuters Venezuela Bureau Chief, and Tamara Tarasuk-Broner is the Senior Americas Researcher for Human Rights Watch. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
The assault on the American auto industry, believe me, is over. It's over.
From the beginning, the Trump administration has cast itself as an ally of the auto industry.
I think as an industry, we're excited about working together with the president and his administration on tax policies, on regulation, and on trade to really create a renaissance in American manufacturing.
That was then Ford CEO Mark Field speaking outside the White House in January 2017. One policy that automakers were eager to work on with President Trump was an Obama-era rule that created new standards for tailpipe emissions. Under those guidelines, by 2025, car companies would be expected to produce cars that average over 50 miles per gallon. Here's Coral Davenport, an energy and environment correspondent for The New York Times.
It basically forces automakers to aggressively start ramping up the fuel economy of vehicles, investing heavily in producing electric, hybrid, and high fuel economy vehicles. And the ultimate outcome is that it cuts U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, about the equivalent of 2 years of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions.
Coral's been reporting on President Trump's plans to drastically roll back those Obama-era standards. And while you might think that that is good news for the auto industry, last week, 17 of the biggest automakers from the U.S. and around the world wrote to President Trump telling him to reconsider. I spoke with Coral to find out more about what the auto industry is asking for from the White House and why car companies agreed to the Obama-era rule in the first place.
The Obama administration said this is an incredibly ambitious mandate. The automakers agreed to it in part because at the time, the administration was still bailing them out after the financial meltdown. And so they were getting huge loans from the administration, which is how they got brought to the table. But they said it's going to be very hard to meet this. And we would like to go back, maybe not get it all wiped out, but essentially just get some wiggle room, maybe get a little more time, maybe get, you know, be able to sort of trade off and get some credit for some other good environmental things that we're doing. We just don't want it to be like quite so tough and quite so ambitious. And so when President Trump came in, the CEOs of the big three came to him and said, hey, you know, we've got this Obama era mandate. Could we sort of figure out, you know, some way where it's just not quite as hard? And of course, President Trump campaigned on being a champion of these sort of bedrock traditional American manufacturing industries, the auto industry more than anything else, and took it and ran with it, basically put forward a proposal saying, we're going to roll this almost all the way back, you know, to the equivalent of having almost no regulation whatsoever. And that's where things got weird.
So the automakers signed a letter, right? A bunch of different automakers signed a letter to President Trump. What is it that they're looking for specifically? I mean, why is it that they're... I know one of the things they're worried about is sort of having different standards in different states, and they're saying that that would be bad for business, right?
Yes. So what happened is Trump comes in, the automakers go to him and say, hey, we're hoping you could just sort of loosen and soften it and make it a little bit easier for us. However, the Obama mandate also came into being through a deal that was cut with the state of California. The Obama emissions requirements actually mirror a state-level set of emissions requirements put in place in California. California has a special deal under the law, under the 1970 Clean Air Act, where they get to make their own stronger state-level standards than national federal standards if they want. And 13 other states also follow this. And these states, led by California, have made very clear, hey, President Trump, if you roll back these standards, we're going to keep these aggressive Obama-level standards, which are our state-level standards, and we're going to sue. We're going to sue to keep them. And that is what the automakers absolutely dread. The states that will sue to keep their higher state-level standards represent about a third of the U.S. auto market. And so if you have a scenario where there's about a third of the market has one set of emission standards, and then the rest of it has a completely different set of standards, and there will be a lawsuit, it's entirely possible that the states could sue to keep their standards in place and sue to put the federal standard back in place or not, or something in between. And automakers need to be planning out their models of what they're going to build and how they're going to sell and what they're going to do years and years in advance. And so the Trump proposal to roll it all back creates this scenario where there's an expectation of lawsuits and litigation going on for years and years, probably ending up at the Supreme Court, with creating sort of total market uncertainty. It also could create, indeed, this kind of split market with one set of states, you know, and these aren't necessarily states that are all next to each other. So it kind of would create a patchwork where you could have a mix of states that have one standard and a mix of states that have other standards. This is the total nightmare scenario that the automakers absolutely do not want.
Well, and also on Friday, a White House spokesman said that the administration is going to go forward with finalizing this rule change anyway, despite the letter, despite the opposition from automakers. Coral, what does the timeline look like for that so far? And have you heard differently?
So EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler gave a speech last week in which he said that he anticipates the final rule to be out by the end of the month, end of June. That is at odds with everything that I am hearing in my own reporting about what is being worked on with this. What I'm told from sort of the people who are actually preparing the rule is, you know, there's all these sort of like legal justification documents they have to do. They haven't done all of that. They're not wrapping up. They're not at a point where they could just put this out in a couple weeks with a bow on it, that there's still a lot more work to do. And so a more realistic timeframe is maybe end of the summer, maybe even September. If sort of things drag out that long, maybe it's possible that there could be a deal, although it's hard to see. I mean, this president in particular relishes, you know, both pushing back, kind of antagonizing those who antagonize him. And of his many antagonists, one of his favorites is the state of California. Frankly, it's hard to see how a deal could be reached. But my reporting, at least, is showing that the final plan is still a couple months off, so anything can happen.
Also, just to round it out here, at the top, we mentioned that this is really a response to the Obama-era regulations that were some of the most significant, if you will, in trying to combat climate change. Coral, if this Trump administration rollback does go into effect, what would the environmental impact be?
Oh, it would be tremendous. This was the most substantive greenhouse gas cutting policy that not just the Obama administration, but the federal government has ever put forward. It would have cut, you know, about a million tons of emissions. So if this rollback goes into effect, even if 13 states keep higher state level emissions in place, that would not wipe out the Obama regulation entirely, but it would wipe out probably about two-thirds of the impact. So we would see about two-thirds more of those emissions going back into the atmosphere.
Coral Davenport is an energy and environment correspondent for The New York Times. Coral, thank you.
Great to be with you, Tanzina. Thank you.
More than 4 in 5 American Indian and Alaska Native women have experienced violence in their lifetime. More than half of this population has experienced sexual violence. And in some counties across the country, Native women face murder rates that are more than 10 times the national average. These are the numbers that show the scope of the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the United States. But as we've reported on this show, the data are incomplete. Late last year, the Urban Indian Health Institute, which is a division of the Seattle Indian Health Board, found that Salt Lake City ranks among the top 10 cities in the United States where Indigenous women go missing, and Utah ranks among the top 10 states. The Salt Lake Police Department has questioned some of their findings, and you can find their response by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. But last week, The Takeaway hosted a live event with KUER in Salt Lake City to talk about it. My guests were Jennifer Boyce, campaign chair of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives of Utah, a PANDOS organization. And I was also joined by Representative Angela Romero, a Democrat who represents District 26 in the State House. She's also a minority assistant whip in the House and has made this issue a priority. And my third guest was Graham Lee Brewer, a contributing editor for Tribal Affairs at High Country News and a board member of the Native American Journalists Association. And I began by asking Graham why we're only just beginning to reckon with this problem here in the United States.
Well, it probably depends a little bit on who you ask, but there are quite a few reasons why the data is insufficient. So the federal government does track a lot of this data, but unfortunately, they don't necessarily share it with tribal governments. Tribal governments don't have a lot of access to the data, so it's hard for them to understand the scope of the problem within their own tribal nations. And more importantly, a lot of police departments within the United States don't properly track data. They don't properly track race. And oftentimes when they do, they miscategorize Indigenous women as either white or Hispanic. And so there's not a lot of communication. There's not a lot of data being shared. And so a lot of the gaps in the data are actually being filled by activists and not people in law enforcement. Really, you've seen a lot of the resiliency that defines a lot of Native nations. You're seeing that in this new push to get more data out there. So the Urban Indian Health Institute study that you cited earlier, that's probably the most comprehensive understanding we have of the problem in a lot of those areas. And as that report will state, it's woefully inaccurate because of this huge lack in data. I think when we look at that report in specific, one of the numbers that really jumps out to me is that the oldest case in the report is from 1943, but two-thirds of the cases that are in the report come from 2010 to 2018. That really right there illustrates the scope of the problem, right? That from 1943 to 2010, I can only assume that more than a third of those cases probably occurred. So there's this huge gap, and we are really only just now beginning to scratch the surface level and really understand the scope of the problem.
Representative Romero, I know a lot of people hear about violence against Native women and immediately think of a couple of things. One is that it only happens on tribal lands, and the second is that it only happens within Native communities. Are those myths? And if so, can you help us debunk them?
Those are definitely myths. I represent House District 26, which is the east side and the west side of Salt Lake City. And the Urban Indian Center resides in my district. And even going back to the data, there's a lot of myths that if you're indigenous here, that you live on the reservation. And as we know, many people, majority actually live in an urban setting. And their perpetrators are not indigenous.
Jennifer, this came up earlier, but I want to talk about this issue of miscategorization a little bit more in terms of how big a role that miscategorization of Native women plays in the larger problem.
Well, if you think about it, if we're not categorized as who we are, then whenever the numbers are put forth to actually indicate who is missing, who is murdered, and how many, we aren't included in that, in those numbers. And so I think that creates a big issue for us later on down the line because we don't know the scope, and maybe we'll never know the scope. That's honestly how I feel, that maybe we'll never know the entire scope because this has been going on for ages. But going forward, I think that's extremely important to start doing and to start understanding, because if they don't understand us as a people, that's a clear indication that genocide is working.
When you say the genocide was working, you mean you felt erased?
Yeah. No one recognized me for who I am, except for my tribe. My tribes have always recognized me and known. I mean, my Mayan side is really, they're really confused when they see how tall I am, but they still recognize me, you know, as their own, as a catracha in Honduras and as well, but indigenous from there. And so, I mean, how amazing would it be to live in a world where people know your identity and that it's not a bad thing or that it's not something to be ashamed of?
I want to turn a minute to talk about jurisdiction and who has jurisdiction over cases of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. Graham, can you tell us a little bit about if something happens on a tribal land or if it happens right in the middle of Salt Lake City, what is the difference? Who has the jurisdiction there?
Federal prosecutors have jurisdiction typically in tribal lands when it's a felony case. So Congress has placed pretty extreme limits on what tribes can prosecute and what tribal police officers can arrest people for. So it typically falls into, you know, misdemeanors, low-level felonies, because most courts can only give up to a year in prison, I think, and it's like $500 or $5,000 in fines. So federal prosecutors step in, and sometimes this can be a good thing because federal prosecutors come with federal resources. But as Mary Houdetz, a really great Associated Press reporter, reported in October, really, I think it's like 46% of those cases were declined by federal prosecutors for prosecution. So
did they give a reason why?
Most of them were a lack of evidence, is what they said. So I think if you look to Alaska for an example, there are 75, I believe, Alaskan villages that do not have police force, and when you put in the added barrier of weather and having to take like maybe a boat or a plane to a remote region, getting justice can take a long time. So there's programs like Safe Star, for instance, which trains people on the ground to start doing basic examinations and the very beginnings of an investigation for things like a sexual assault, for instance, because those resources might be 2 or 3 days away if they ever come at all. And, you compound that with the idea that many Native people don't trust the police. That NPR did a poll last year that showed that 36% of Native Americans, when they need to call the police, they don't because they fear them. So all of these things add up, and it increases the scope of the problem quite exponentially.
Representative Romero, I want to ask you about jurisdiction, but this time looking at the Violence Against Women Act, which has had various iterations. Where does this stand today in terms of, particularly in terms of domestic violence, non-Native men and Native men?
That's up for discussion again, and I was researching that because majority of my work is at a local level. So when you look at sexual assault, even at a local level, and we're not even addressing Native women, we're addressing all women. We even have the hard conversation of disbelieving that sexual assault or domestic violence happened. And so then you add on that next layer and it's even more difficult to prove. And so what we've found with, since we've been talking about sexual violence and domestic violence, I mean, that's what I've based my legislative career on, and I've served in the legislature since 2013. So our whole goal was just to have the conversation that we say, start by believing, and we were talking about start by believing before Me Too. For us to even have the conversation about domestic violence and sexual assault and for people to report is already difficult, and then you add on those other barriers, it's not good. But I know recently what was added into VAWA, the congresswoman from New Mexico wanted to provide victims that are in urban settings to have a victim advocate. And so that's kind of what they're looking forward at past the House, but we have to see what happens in the Senate.
Jennifer, this is a very personal issue for you. You've had a member of your family, members of your family who've been victims of violence, and including a cousin of yours that some people have probably heard in the news, Faith Hedgepath. Are you okay talking about her a little bit and telling us about her story?
Only if you got tissues. Just putting that out there. it never gets easier. I've had 6 family members that are either missing or murdered. Both my grandparents at different times. And I just remember growing up with all of these stories. Because from a young age, you wonder where your grandparents are. You wonder where your family is and why they're not around or what happened to them. I also had my Auntie Pablita, which I don't resemble because I'm a mixture of several tribes. I don't resemble either my parents very much, but I look just like her. But when she was 26, her husband killed her in Missouri. He was not Native. And then I have my cousins. When I was attending grad school, my younger cousin was attending her sophomore year at UNC Chapel Hill. I believe she was on scholarship. She's extremely, extremely smart, very bright, and she was found raped and murdered in her dorm. And they still have not found her attacker. So what the community back home from, this is from my stepdad's tribe in North Carolina, what they've done is they've created a college scholarship in her honor to give to Native women, young women in the community, in her name, and to remember her and to honor her. And last April, one of my really close cousins was, sorry, I grew up with him my whole life, and he was killed. Back home in North Carolina as well, from the same Native community. And it was just extremely devastating because I had already gotten into this work because of my grandparents, because of my auntie, because of my cousin. And then to have this happen, it just feels really difficult to keep going. But I'm surrounded by a lot of amazing people that make this work a whole lot easier than it could be. And I also have another cousin, Larissa Lone Hill, who is missing at this time. She's been missing for over 2 years from my tribe in South Dakota. And she just disappeared one day, and they don't know what's happened to her. And that happens every day. This is normal for us.
So many times, particularly in the media, we hear about these things and we intellectualize these issues and we look at them as numbers and percentages. And I want to thank you for putting names and experiences and real faces for this audience to understand that this is a real issue. It's not just a figure. It's not just something that we intellectualize. And I know that was painful, and I appreciate you sharing that with this audience. Thank you very much, Jennifer. To that point, I think this raises the issue of media coverage, or lack thereof, of Native women, Indigenous communities. Graham, I want to pivot back to you for a second. You work with media organizations on this. issue. What are they doing wrong? What are they missing? And where can they improve?
I'm going to start where they can improve. And I think the thing I always say the most, when media organizations ask me, how can we do this better? I say, hire indigenous journalists. Crystal Echohawk did a great study last year. And it found that in national newsrooms, the staff of national newsrooms are 0.36% Native American. At High Country News, we're the only non-Native-owned national outlet that has a desk fully devoted to the coverage of Indian country, and almost all of us on the tribal affairs desk are tribal citizens. But there's a lot of misconception, a lot of stereotype, a lot of myth. I think with this topic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in particular, there are a lot of victim and community blaming. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a story about a suicide epidemic in a reservation that is attributed to ghosts or spirits. I would look to marginalization, disenfranchisement, colonization. I would look at those things for the reason why those suicide rates are high, not ghosts or spirits. I also see a lot of things that researchers classify as violent language when we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Things like Sarah Deer, who is a really great, prolific scholar and writer on this topic. I hear her say this all the time in interviews, that we marginalize these women more and more because we say, well, you know, she shouldn't have been running around with that guy. She shouldn't have been out drinking. She is a drug addict. Whatever excuse you want to throw into there, it's an excuse not to properly investigate that. And so we see that furthered and perpetuated by the media coverage. I also think that media, national media in particular, does a really poor job of what we call parachuting into an area of Indian country, and their only job there is to cover tragedy. That's another thing I always tell media organizations when they ask, how can we do this better? Don't just show up in a tribal community to cover the bad things. So I'm a member of the Cherokee Nation, grew up in Norman, Oklahoma. My Oklahoma history class pretty much started with the land run, right? So at the Native American Journal Association, we all are constantly kind of talking about the fact that we're making up for these gross inadequacies in our public education system. Like you mentioned earlier, less than 30% of Native Americans live on reservations. We're a very urban people. And I think it's important to remember that while historical trauma is a part of our history as Indigenous people, no Indigenous person wants to be defined by that. And so I think when you are seeking out that information, go find writers of color who are putting their thoughts out there, and don't necessarily look to your Native friends to answer all those questions for you, because it's not really their job. It's not incumbent upon Indigenous people to teach you how to not be racist.
That was Graham Lee Brewer, contributing editor for Tribal Affairs at High Country News, Jennifer Boyce, campaign chair of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives of Utah, a PANDOS organization, and Representative Angela Romero, a state lawmaker and Democrat who represents House District 26. And if you want to check out my full conversation with the panel, which includes a Q&A with our audience on the topic, you can visit thetakeaway.org. There's a link to a full video stream of the event. And thanks again to KUER and Salt Lake City for hosting this important conversation. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.